This is The Guardian.
I'm Jane Lee, coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and this is The Full Story. The number of children with disabilities needing extra learning support has grown to almost 1 million around Australia. Senior Investigations correspondent Sarah Martin has been looking into the experiences of neurodiverse students in particular.
We've seen there are huge inequities in the system. There's abuse, there's discrimination of children with disabilities in our schools.
And she's found that many are unable to get the help that they need.
I only realised he had a mental health issue probably the second day before I pulled him out of that school. I had come to collect him and I had cried at him about my need to be able to work and his need to get an education. And he told me that he would try to go in. And so I walked back with him to the classroom and he couldn't step through the threshold.
Students with disabilities are increasingly being suspended from school, including children as young as five. So where does that leave students and their families? And what needs to change?
If we don't work out how to actually incorporate an education system that works well with children, then we are letting down an entire generation of young people.
Today, how Australian schools are failing students with disabilities. It's Monday, the 6th of May.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So Sarah, you've been investigating the way children with disabilities are treated in Australian schools, because we know that most of these kids are not being educated in specialised settings. What has stood out to you the most?
I think the thing that has really stood out to me is that in a system that you would have thought that everyone should be on the same page, that teachers and parents and the system as a whole would want every child to get the best education, very often it has become quite adversarial. And even though there are obviously really good teachers and a lot of families make the point that they're, you know, certain individual teachers are trying very hard, there does seem to be a lot of cases where parents feel like they're battling the school, and that really surprised me.
One of the parents we heard from in this story was Alicia Cook.
I live in Launceston in Tasmania. I'm a sole parent and my son Emerson is 8 years old.
And for someone who's never met Emerson, tell me a little bit about him.
He is a very cheeky character and has always been a wonderful personality. He is very bright. He's very determined and he really loves gaming and Pokemon and stuff like that.
When did you first start seeing signs that Emerson was unhappy or struggling at school?
It started well before he went to school, but when he got to school and when he moved into year one, that's probably where the rubber starts to hit the road for a young person. And I would be getting an email probably daily from the teacher about Emerson's behaviour at school. And it was really stressful because he was attending a private school and I was paying fees and I was feeling really frustrated that I was trying to give him the best educational experience I could, and it felt like it was being frittered away because he wasn't able to engage with it. But what I didn't really understand is that by the time you have a behavioural response to stress and anxiety, it's actually you're down the pointy end.
So, Sarah, is Emerson's experience at school common among children with disabilities?
Yeah, so in my research, I have found obviously there's very mixed experiences, and I think every child is different and has different needs and has had a different experience. However, there are some really common themes. So day-to-day, children with disabilities often have behavioural challenges, and these are not necessarily being supported in a way that is needed. Then there are behaviours that manifest from mental health issues or social developmental disabilities like autism and ADHD, which are treated punitively in the school system rather than with the support that is needed. And then that means that ultimately that child's needs are not being met and they're not getting the education they could get, like in Alicia's case.
Eventually we had the ADHD diagnosis and started some medication, and immediately that assisted with the anxiety. So we had not a complete transformation but a very significant improvement. But what I've learned is that it's like a roller coaster. It undulates. It's not like you just do one thing and it fixes the problem. So we'd still have challenges around him being at school. He'd still be trying to run away and climb the fence. He'd still end up in the deputy principal's office all the time. There were no dedicated resources for him, so I would be asked to pick him up after an hour or two in the morning most days.
There are also a lot of families struggling with school refusal, which they actually prefer to use the term school can't, because school refusal suggests that it's a choice rather than the result of some sort of stress in that child's life.
There's really this systematic approach when there aren't enough resources to support children who need assistance and who don't have formal diagnoses, because he didn't have an autism diagnosis at that time. They actually put it back on the parents, and it's a form of exclusion. And it's actually really wrong that this is happening, because it ends up baking in more school avoidance.
So children in those categories, they often fall behind, and those behavioural problems are getting worse or not addressed, and it's also causing havoc for those families' home lives and work lives, often for the parents.
I suppose it just reached a point where it became really clear to me that Emerson hadn't been learning anything for the last 2 years because he was so stressed. And it wasn't going to be an issue that we could just fix, and that he would be able to go to school for the next 12 years. Basically, I recognised that it was always going to be challenging for him, and he couldn't articulate what the stresses were, and he still can't tell me what the issues are. And schools are busy places and they are noisy, and sometimes it's really hard for kids like this to be there.
Sarah, you also found some trends in the way that children with disabilities are being disciplined at school, right?
Unfortunately, it is commonplace in the Australian school system that children with disabilities are suspended or excluded disproportionately. That comes as a result of some of these behavioural challenges not being addressed in other ways in the classroom. And obviously, all schools also need to keep staff and other students safe. But, you know, particularly in the early years of schooling, that is happening with children as young as five. And there's calls for changes to how that behaviour is managed, rather than just booting out the kid at a time of really core learning in those early years. And then, of course, in more extreme examples, you have physical restraints. We reported in one case, which is currently being conciliated by the Human Rights Commission, that a six-year-old boy was strapped into a baby's high chair for up to 8 hours a day, according to his family. And that is certainly an example of an inappropriate use of a restrictive practice, as the school obviously didn't have a way of supporting that child appropriately. So, you know, I think the problem with the fact that schools are resorting to those crude measures, again, it comes down to the fact that they clearly don't have anything else in the toolkit. Their resources are stretched. They have, you know, perhaps outdated ideas of discipline. I mean, if you're expecting a six-year-old child with autism to reflect on their behaviour, and, you know, it's sort of a punitive response to behaviour that's beyond their control. So it's not really appropriate at all. And it can also traumatise them, but it also can lead to really negative connotations with the school and make them not want to go.
Why are we looking at this issue now? Has the number of children with disabilities in schools actually changed?
It's a really good question, and there's actually quite a lot of contention about the difference between the prevalence of some of these conditions and the diagnosis rates of some of these conditions. So obviously there's a cohort of students who previously would have had some of these disabilities that weren't captured in any way because the systems weren't set up to report them. The numbers that we can rely upon are the number of students that are reported to ACARA, the Australian Curriculum Authority, about students who require an adjustment who have a disability. And those figures are basically based on the assessment of the teacher and the school. It doesn't require a diagnosis. It's basically a teacher saying that child is having a difficulty learning because of a disability, whether or not that's been diagnosed. And this is the sort of adjustment we have to make to help educate them. And what we can tell from those numbers is that figure has grown quite rapidly in recent years. So there are about 1 million children in Australian schools at the moment who have a disability. That figure has jumped about 40% since 2017. And social and emotional disabilities have grown at almost 10% a year. And that's compared to enrolment growth of about 1% a year over the same period. So there is a lot of debate, and obviously there's still a lot of research into what is behind the increase in prevalence. But the figures that we can rely on in terms of what the teacher sees in the classroom, that suggests that there is a growth in the number of children who have a disability.
Or at least a growth in the recognition of the needs of this group of children in the school system.
Absolutely.
So we know that schools are under-resourced to support children with disabilities, and we also know that the number of children who need that support is growing. So how is that affecting teachers?
You know, the problem is that the teachers are stretched. They feel that they are having to do sort of endless paperwork in order to support students with a disability, but they're not given the time to do it. And they've got really complex classrooms that may have a number of children with disabilities. They may also have a number of children without disabilities who also have high needs. They could have children who are from out of home care. They could have children with mental health problems. They could have all sorts of issues in a classroom. I mean, you know, teachers are reporting that their levels of stress are higher than ever before, but I think resources are a huge part of this equation. So we've reported the union's latest State of Our School survey, which has basically surveyed principals and teachers about how they're managing the needs of students with disability at their schools. And 90% of principals said they were using funds from other areas of their budget to support students with disability at their school because they had been ineligible for targeted government funding or the amount that they were receiving was inadequate. So that suggests that there's a huge shortfall in the resources that are flowing to schools. And some of the principals reported running budget deficits in order to fund support workers. You know, one principal in Queensland reported that a child who was blind didn't have a teacher's aide because they couldn't get funding for one. You know, there was a child with level 3 autism who was nonverbal, who was only allocated 6 hours of teacher aide time when he needs 30 hours of teacher aide time. And I think it's really important to stress that there's no suggestion that children with disabilities and high needs are causing these problems. I think it's really important to stress that this is a system that is failing our children. It's not in any way the fault of the child. And I think no one disputes the fact that classrooms are far more complex than they used to be, and yet teachers are not given any more time to try to manage that complexity. And so they're very stressed and overworked and don't feel at all supported in the system.
Next, why schools have limited resources to support high-needs students.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So in your reporting, you found that private schools receive far more funding on average to support students with disabilities than public schools. Tell me about that.
So the funding picture is an absolute nightmare, and it took me quite a long time to get my head around this because the federal government pays a loading for students with a disability. Now, the federal government, for historical reasons, is the primary funder of non-government schools, and the state governments are the primary funders of government schools. So as a result of that sort of direct line between the federal government and the non-government schools, so the student with disability loading payment goes directly to the school in most cases, or the approved authority, which can run, for example, systemic schools like Catholic schools, for example. So because of that direct line in funding from the Commonwealth to non-government schools, it's a very clear sort of payment for a student with a disability. And basically the school reports what sort of an adjustment they have to make to support that child's education, and the federal government pays the loading accordingly. And the loading changes depending on the severity of the disability. But for a child in the public school system, that data is reported to the federal government. The federal government then pays the state government 20% of that loading amount, and then the state government does its own assessment as to who should have that funding. And the problem is, and the inequity arises, because the state government is not topping up the payment to the same level that the federal government pays the private schools. And there's no transparency about how much will go to the child who has the required need. And there is no transparency for the family. There's no transparency for the school. And the state governments aren't able to tell us, for example, what a student in a particular category of need is actually receiving in terms of individual funding support compared to what that child in the private sector is getting. So it is an absolute mess. It's really unfair. And it's been one of those issues that has been raised with the government. And what we've sort of seen is that this funding inequity is really making it even more challenging for public schools to manage this growth in the number of children with a disability.
What about if you just look at the public school system? Is support for students with disabilities fairly distributed around the country?
So every state has a different way of determining access. So in some states, for example, the child would have to have a diagnosis. In other states, they do a functional assessment, which is similar to what happens with the funding for the private schools. So there's very little transparency about what support is linked to what level of need. And you can have situations where a child in one school with the same level of need may be getting something different to a child in another school, which is, you know, obviously inherently unfair.
Mm. So we're seeing schools often failing, despite their best efforts, to support students with disabilities, in some cases even excluding them from school because of their behavioural problems. Where does that leave these students and their families?
What I've heard, when the sort of relationship with the school breaks down, families are really left reeling. I mean, you know, it's a big thing to have to start again, move house, move city, move schools. It's a huge amount of upheaval. And also I think it's really interesting if you look at it from a systemic level. I mean, kicking a kid out of a school and putting them into another school doesn't ever get to any of the sort of reasons that that child is being suspended or excluded or having those behavioural problems. And if the supports don't exist in one school to manage that, then on a sort of systemic view of things, it's very unlikely that those supports are going to exist in the next school. You're just sort of repeating the pattern of behaviour and gives them the opposite. It doesn't give them what they need. You know, parents want the best for their child, and obviously they want the best mental health for their child, and they want to ensure their child is as supported as possible. And I think for many families, the decision to homeschool comes after having tried everything else.
I mean, that's what happened with Alicia Cook. She eventually decided to homeschool her son Emerson after she tried sending him to 3 different schools in 2 different states.
There was no alternative for me. I believe he has a right to an education. He's a bright child who has a lot to give to the world, and it would be criminal for him not to receive the opportunities to learn. And yesterday he was talking to me about this is a child who has learning difficulties which were never picked up by the schools he attended. He struggles with his English books that I do with him, and at the same time yesterday he was talking to me about the difference between the protagonist and the antagonist. And this is an 8-year-old who also, 2 weeks before that, was accurately describing what the fourth wall was. And this is the only way for him to learn. He needs a really contemporary learning approach that is sensitive to his needs, and I wish the education system recognised that they need to do this for all children, but in the absence of that, I have to do it for him.
A lot of the parents I've spoken to are really frustrated. They're quite burnt out and exhausted, and they also feel that there's sort of this power imbalance with the school. I mean, parents don't want to have to move schools. They don't want to have to try and find a new school for their child or move to homeschooling. They would like the school that they have their kid in to be working, but that very often doesn't seem to be the case.
You know, you've been looking at this for a long time, Sarah, and there's obviously a lot of inherent systemic problems that are built in, and there's no quick fixes here. But what do you think urgently needs to happen to improve education levels for children with disabilities in this country?
I think you're right that there is no silver bullet, but there's certainly lots of changes that can be made that would improve the school life for students with disabilities. So improving training for teachers to recognise support children with disabilities, making schools better spaces for children. There's been a lot of talk about the architecture of schools, needing spaces for children with autism to go, for example, who are experiencing sensory overload. There has to be something done about the funding inequities between private and public schools in Australia. That has been a long-standing issue in Australia's education system. The Gonski reforms were supposed to fix that, and they haven't. The funding has to be part of the solution, because a lot of the resources that are required to support children with disabilities cost money, and the resources just aren't there. But as one advocate told me, it's a broken system. It's not just about the funding. It's about cultural change. It's about getting parents, teachers and students on the same page.
I will say we have been completely failed by the systems, and there's not an understanding of how anxiety is presenting in young people, and there's not an understanding about neurodiversity and what that looks like. And given the incidence of neurodivergence in the community and in young people, and the fact that this is increasing, if we don't work out how to actually incorporate an education system that works well with children, then we are letting down an entire generation of young people. I wish schools understood how anxiety presents in young people and recognise that sometimes when there's a behaviour that's being presented, it's perhaps a mental health issue and not necessarily someone who is misbehaving.
That was Alicia Cook, a parent from Tasmania. And earlier, you also heard from Sarah Martin. She's a senior correspondent for Guardian Australia's investigative unit. You can find more of Sarah's reporting on this issue at theguardian.com. It's part of a really great investigative series called The Classroom Divide. We've linked to some of her latest articles on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannon. The executive producer was Miles Martignoni. And if you like this episode, don't forget to follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also leave us a review. I'm Jane Lee. Catch you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.